I'm Frank Vaughn. It's April 1st, 2025, and as a serious person, I despise April Fool's Day, so there will be no tomfoolery in this video. Bah humbug! Let us begin. Right out the gate, let's dispense with the scandals du jour. Honorable Lisa McCormick Raitt says, when you're more outraged by a conservative MP using the term biological clock than by a liberal MP encouraging the turning in of a Canadian citizen to a foreign government in exchange for a bounty, you may have lost the plot. Not just any foreign government, the communist government of China, which has a tendency to execute foreigners it deems inconvenient. But what I really want to talk about is Gator's response. Why isn't it possible to be turned off by both? Is this the pearl-clutching and performative rage Olympics? This says so much. Two mistakes. One side apologizes and resigns over it. The other side ignores it because what about the liberals? So telling. This is ridiculous. Women are real. They are different from men. Men can't be women. Women can't be men. Women have a biological clock. They're only fertile for so long. And if they're engaged in tax slavery for all of their fertile years, you don't have children. You have collapsing demography. A nation can disappear, or a nation can disappear while it is replaced with a new nation that nobody recognizes. That is the process that is ongoing right now. 40, 50 years ago, one person making one income could support an entire family and stable demographics. But ever since Pierre Elliott Trudeau came along, all we get is more taxation, more burden. The more money you make, the more they take. They can't balance a budget to save their lives, so they print money. They inflate the money supply, further robbing you almost as much or worse as the taxation that they apply to you without any recourse on your part to do anything about it. So taxation's one that you can see. We like to talk about the carbon tax. We like to talk about tax burdens. But the inflation burden is also a tax. So when they overspend, when they run deficits, when they accrue debt at all levels of government, they're robbing you with another form of taxation. And that is why you can't afford to live in most parts of this country. I remind people, there's lots of cheap places to live all over this country. You just have to want to live there. But I digress. The burden is unreproachably greater than it was decades ago. That's what our politicians are talking. That's what Pierre Poilievre is talking about. And why are people getting offended at this? These people, Gator Gum, nasty Canadian, very appropriately named, is somebody who believes men can be women, and women can be men, and it's a simple choice. Well, it's not. But all of a sudden, they're upset that somebody's talking about the biological reality of women, and that men have no place talking about what... It's so funny how they can occupy two completely juxtaposed positions at the exact same time. One being that men should have no place in the conversation about women, reproductive rights, etc. Alongside the fact that men, regardless of what their choice is, if the woman that they're paired with gets pregnant and decides to leave, the man is responsible financially for that child until that child becomes an adult and sometimes well into adulthood. I know guys personally that are still paying support payments for children that are in their 20s because they can't find somebody to fix the garnishment of their wages. The system is totally broken. The other thing is, if the woman decides to kill that child in the womb, the man has no recourse. There's no recourse at all. So he's liable if they keep it. He is without choice if they decide to terminate. I knew a guy back east. His girlfriend got pregnant. She was 6 months into the pregnancy. And without informing him, the guy was decorating the nursery. He was so stoked about having a child. But at 6 months, for emotional reasons, hormonal reasons, I don't know what the reasons were in her mind, she went and unilaterally got an abortion in the second trimester. He was devastated. And of course, he left her. But he had no recourse. The poor man lost his child. But no one cares about him. So as long as that situation exists, on that level, you have to tolerate our opinions. As long as we have to pay or we have no recourse, we get to discuss this. And secondly, if being a woman is a construct and men can just self-identify as women and become a woman in your mind, how do you square the circle that you think men don't get to have an opinion about women, but we can assume the identity whenever we want? It doesn't make any sense. It's not reasonable, and so much of so-called progressivism is actually regressivism because it's not rational whatsoever. Sharon Tracy says she lost it a long time ago. CTV has no integrity to hire her as a fact-checker. 13 people liked it, and 2 people retweeted it. What's the problem here? That she tilts her head to the biological reality that women are different from men and that they actually have a biological clock that's ticking down? We have demographic catastrophe here in this country. Somebody should be opening that conversation as to why people don't want to have children. And this brings me to another point at the bottom of these comments. People don't want to settle down and have kids. That's so boomer. I regret never having kids. The only thing I want to point out here is I spent so many years of my life thinking that kids were unaffordable, thinking that we couldn't make it, thinking that family would be a burden, that how would I ever live my life if I had children in it? Because I've been programmed. I was programmed in high school through so-called home economic courses that made you carry a baby home and painted this picture of the burden to try and stave off teenage pregnancy. You can argue that that's a noble goal. The thing is, there's many a teenager or many a young adult who gets pregnant, and that child saves their lives. It makes them into the adults. It turns them into fully functional humans. And some fall apart. But the messaging stuck with me, that it was a burden, that it was a bad idea, that it would be economic suicide. And then one day I did it. And I discovered, through the process of having my first child, that it was all hooey. You will find a way. Do you understand that the poorest people in this country have the most children? And those children and those parents find a way to keep their family fed? Do you understand that as a poor person in this country, there's a lot of government supports already? We heavily subsidize, through programs of the federal government, the having of children, because without children, there is no society. There's a lot of people who talk about replacement theory. It's not really a theory, it's ongoing. People talk about social cohesion, ethnic cohesion, yet most of the loudest voices in the community don't have any children. And the excuse they offer up is it's unaffordable. It's really not. Children don't cost that much money. They cost as much as you want to make them cost. And they are, without a doubt, for good and noble people, for people who care, for people who actually question their ethics and their morals and frame their lives and try to improve their lives, children are the single best experience you will ever have, bar none. There's no other experience that's as good. And the tragedy is, you don't know that until you've had one. And once you've had one, you're going to want a second one. Most people will want a second one because it's amazing. You get to see it from the other side. If you're lucky enough to have good parents, you've seen it from one side. And even if you've had moderate parents or parents with problems, childhood was still, for most people, a pretty joyous occasion. We've created, in Western society and culture, particularly in North America, we've created the sanctity of childhood in the last 80 years, more or less. Children are no longer expected to work in the coal mine in the field from 5 years old on, but they get to enjoy exploring the world, and it is a wonderful unfolding that you get to witness as a parent. It's fantastic, and you understand your parents fundamentally in such a fundamentally greater way by seeing it from the other side. It's the single best experience. Don't delay it. You'll find a way. It's amazing. And so many people share this sentiment once they get to the end of this biological fertility that Pierre Polyev is highlighting, they regret never doing it. And I got to tell you, knowing what I know now with 2 children, I would Even if I didn't know it, I would have regretted never doing it. If you're thinking about having kids, just do it. You'll find a way. It'll be okay. There's hand-me-downs aplenty. One of the things about declining birth rates means there is a plethora of clothing and toys and the basics that you need that can be had for cheap. And the fact is, even if birth rates weren't declining, the toys and the clothes, they only have a limited window. Do you know how rare it is that we buy new clothes? Do you know how rare it is we buy new clothes? I've had people who get bent out of shape because they see how many educational toys. Like, my kids don't even have the toys that make the noise. They have all kinds of puzzles and advanced learning things that they do. It's all doing stuff. They're not in front of screens all the time. They're always tactile. They're always thoughtful. And people are like, how do you afford all this? Facebook Marketplace, folks. You can have a lot for very little. And if you're just looking and scanning, you'd be amazed what you can find. You can fully kit out your family for very cheap. So this idea that it has to be expensive and it's out of reach, most of the people talking about that have never had children. They have no idea. So take it from me, somebody who's done it, don't delay. Have those kids. You're going to love it. I wasn't really intending to go off on a tangent about family and demography, but here we are, and I think I got to leave it in. Jagmeet Singh says, you didn't solve the housing crisis, you caused it. This is in response to the Liberal Party saying, we solved the housing crisis before. We can solve a housing crisis again. It's time to build. I don't know who needs a reminder of this, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. The Liberals have been in government for the last 10 years. Since 2021, they've been in a minority government, and Jagmeet Singh has kept them there. The policies that these people are saying that they're going to fix, the problems that they're claiming they will solve, were caused by them, period. Jagmeet Singh, I don't know how he takes himself seriously. I don't know how the NDP voter takes him seriously. I don't know how the 6 or 7% of you that are left that are willing to support the NDP, I don't know how you justify yourselves. Seriously. This guy has destroyed your party. You're broke. To finance this campaign, he's gone to the banks to borrow money against your future donations. When he loses this election, when he loses his own seat, when he leaves you potentially seatless, maybe you'll pick up 2 or 3, you're going to be so broke that you may have no future left at all. And so few of you seem to want to hold him and the people who supported him in his caucus accountable for the destitute state that you find yourself in and the absolute moral and ethical bankruptcy that you've brought yourselves to. These are partners. They called it an agreement of supply, but it was a coalition. You can mealy-mouth word your way around anything, but Singh didn't even get you anything for selling your soul to the Liberal Party. He should have demanded a cabinet posting. He didn't. He got some policies, maybe. He got some inclusion. He got some talking points on things the Liberals probably would have done anyway. He's not even a good negotiator for capitulation. The fractal wrongness, the fractal hypocrisy that's contained in these words, I'm surprised my computer hasn't just spontaneously combusted. And just briefly, building on what I talked about yesterday about how Mark Carney is, he says one thing in the morning, he says something different in the afternoon. It's not that he says one thing in French and one thing in English, as is typical of liberal politicians. It's that he has no center. He has no anchor. You have no idea what to expect from this man. Yesterday, Paul Chang was about, he was going to continue his campaign. And then in the afternoon, he resigned. What changed? Has Mark Carney addressed this directly, or did he just move on? I think the answer is self-evident. I don't understand how anybody can trust this guy. It's long been my opinion that trust should be removed from politics. You shouldn't trust any politician. You should pragmatically assess what they offer and see if there's anything of benefit to you for marking an X. But another story that's out there right now, 9 supervised consumption sites in Ontario located near schools and daycare centers have been closed and transitioned into addiction hubs as planned, despite a court order saying they could remain open. So this is interesting because this journalist is including the sentence despite a court order. And that implies that there's relevance. Now, down in the comments, isn't defying a court order a criminal act? Ford is ignoring the courts now the same way Trump does. But let's go back to the article. And I admittedly have scrolled down for you. The move to recovery hubs without drug injection facility is part of a broader policy shift the Ford government is ushering in, saying allowing people to continue to take drugs has not fixed the opioid crisis. I disagree with the word saying. Giving an addict more drugs doesn't fix the addict. We used to know this stuff. Do you fix an alcoholic by handing them more booze, or do you fix them by helping them get away from the booze? Pretty common sense stuff here. The government will spend a total of $550 million on the hubs, which will include 560 supportive housing units for people struggling with addiction. The funding is roughly 4 times more than the same organizations received to dole out drugs. But let's remember that the issue here is about the court order that is supposedly being defied. They have accepted government funding to transition into recovery hubs on Tuesday, April 1st. The funding is contingent on a pledge to end supervised drug consumption. So 8 of the 9 facilities involved have agreed to that contingency. They want the money. So they've agreed voluntarily to do what is required. I'm not really sure where the court order violation is here. This is another outrage farming story where you have a government and a willing partner in these facilities just trying to do work that they both agree to, and the media trying to spin it as though it's something bad. Not giving addicts drugs is a good thing. We have such an inversion of reality that has become commonplace in this country, and it's got to stop somewhere. And let's keep in mind, these 9 facilities are within 200 meters of daycare facilities and schools. So within sight of your little kids, they're giving out hard drugs to addicts, hard drugs that take them out of their own cognizance, turn them into zombies, turn them into freaks. It's not just that they pose a threat to those children. It's also what your children see. We should be more concerned about protecting them so that they can safely learn and grow. Instead, we're outrage farming about the poor addicts not having a place to do their drugs. We got to get hard again. There's too much nurturing and there isn't enough tough love. These people should be thrown in facilities and forced to dry out, every single one of them that's on the street. The people who are smoking crack and meth on your public transit should be forcibly confined and made to get clean, not handed more drugs and glass pipes and told that it's not their fault, it's society's fault, that there's too much stigma. They're people too. That's not the way. Look at the destruction that's all around you, the destruction that's been brought on by leftist policy. And since we're on the subject, I've seen this being thrown around on social media that Britain introduces a 2-tiered justice system. England has fallen. Politicians permitted open borders and permanently altered society. England is no longer a Christian nation. They have abandoned their core traditions, beliefs for outsiders who vote for liberal policies. On and on it goes. The guideline states that a pre-sentence report will normally be considered necessary for these cohorts. So that is, you must consider, in the deliverance of justice, the ethnic, cultural, and religious background of the offender. It's not a matter of whether or not they offended. It's where they came from. So if Britain has allowed into their society a large number of people from a society where rape of women or rape of children is normalized – then that rape, when conducted in Britain, should be treated with Nerf gloves. That it should be considered that they weren't raised in an environment where those things were looked down upon, and thus the sentencing should be a lot more lenient. That's Britain. Sounds pretty horrible. But I want you to understand, we pioneered this here in Canada. The Gladue Principles, effective April 1st, 2021, the Gladue Reports program in BC is administered and managed by the BC First Nations Justice Council. Gladue Principles require judges to make decisions that are appropriate to your particular Indigenous heritage or connection. This means the judge, before sentencing the Indigenous, must take into account your community's perspective on the situation, their needs, and their suggested alternatives to jail. Your community can be the Indigenous community where you live or come from, but it's also your support network or the people you interact with, the laws, practices, customs, and legal traditions of your nation, ways of making decisions that are sensitive and appropriate to your culture. All of this is nice-sounding language to say that if you commit a crime, and a lot of crime comes off reserve. We don't talk about this in Saskatchewan. We don't talk about this in the West, but the highest source of criminality is the reserve system itself, is the Indian Act, is the disenfranchisement from a future and from ownership that's experienced every single day on reserve. But our justice system says if they commit a crime, it's not the same as someone else. Some Englishman or Frenchman, or basically somebody white committing that same crime, that punishment must be more lenient for the minority and must be more severe for the majority. That's the Gladue principle in a nutshell. It takes blame off the offender and puts it on society. And it hasn't worked, and it doesn't work. But what we need to make note of is that we are now doing this for all minorities in Canada. Do pre-sentencing reports really help black offenders in Canada's justice system? The issue that is being discussed, and this is a more progressive article, Canadian courts are increasingly applying impact of race and culture assessment reports, otherwise known as enhanced pre-sentence reports, when sentencing offenders. Their use has been much debated among academics, lawyers, parole and probation officers, community workers, social workers, other clinicians, and offenders. These reports are said to address anti-black racism in the justice system. The idea, again, is that if a visible minority in the population is committing a higher percentage of crimes, that it's not the individual's fault, it's not their community's fault, it is the broader society's. Again, it's the big, bad white man discriminating against the criminal. What is lost in the entire discussion is the fact that the individual is committing the crime. Justice is supposed to be blind. We have Lady Justice holding the scales with blindfolds on. In Canada and in the Western world, we're taking the blindfold off and we're sticking our finger on the scale. And instead of making society better, criminality and violent crime has gotten a lot worse. I featured one of these not long ago, and it was the same city that was targeted, Regina. Regina police say that a 48-year-old man considered a high risk to reoffend sexually against female children is living in Regina's Heritage neighborhood. Jason Paul Thorne is now living in a residence that provides supervision, etc. Once they're released, their privacy is protected. Canada has a database of sex offenders, but it is not public. You have no right to know about it because in Canada we are more concerned with protecting recidivists than we are with protecting the public. Who pays for all of this? You have to live in fear if you live in a city, because every single day around this country, dozens of people who have committed heinous crimes that, in reality, should leave them with the inability to see outside of four walls for the rest of their life. And that's if you don't believe we should bring back capital punishment for things like raping children. it's very difficult to maintain composure. People seem to like my composure, so I'm working very hard to do that. But why is it we have to live in fear like this? How is it possible that a person can commit a heinous crime, like stabbing somebody, as I highlighted in a previous video in Vancouver, stab somebody in the morning and is back out on the street in the afternoon, such that the person who got stabbed after being discharged from the hospital sees the person who stabbed them walking the street again? We have revolving door criminal justice. If you actually commit a heinous crime like this individual and you go to court and you get convicted, you get short sentencing. We have to consider your ethnic background and your minority status, and we have to be lenient in your sentencing. So you do your short sentence, and then you get released. And they tell you outright, high risk to reoffend, because the person, the individual, is often getting released from prison, and the first thing they're going to do is get a taste of that perversion that they're dedicated to in their own mind. They don't care if they have to go back to jail for a little while, because it's a joke. The system in Canada is a joke. Like, we are living in a crime-filled hellhole of a country. I have shown you in these videos and in my work how Canada has become overrun by organized crime, the money laundering, the drugs, the human trafficking, the terrorist financing, all happening here in Canada. And so few are actually talking about it and putting meat on the bones and trying to highlight the scale. But at an individual level, as you live your life, as you go about your business of being a wage slave and a tax slave, you have to walk through the minefield that they have created for you. The public transit that you rely on to get back and forth to work, that you want to put your kids on to go to school, they got to sit there beside crackheads and meth heads and fence zombies. And they have to risk that. Some poor kid has to risk touching a surface that's contaminated with either disease or with the leftovers of drugs that could kill them just by touching it. And we think that this is just. We think that this is correct. We think that this is right. You have an election before you right now. The government has been in power for 10 years, enabled by their NDP partners. They want more of this. They want more crime on your streets. They want the status quo of organized criminality on transnational scale. I've shown you how the world recognizes what Canada is. The only people who seem confused about it are Canadians themselves. Your media, oh, we better do that. Let's, at the risk of making this a little bit longer, and there's a headline right there. Canadian banks linked to Chinese fentanyl laundering risk, U.S. Treasury sanctions after cartel terror designation. This is getting international attention now, but we need to get more legs underneath it, because it should be a much, much bigger story. And maybe this is the reason you're not being told this story. Media outlets receiving Google payments from the Online News Act. So not only is the government subsidizing the media directly with tax dollars, they're soliciting or getting money from private organizations so that those organizations can continue to do business here in Canada. Money has started to flow to the Canadian news outlets from the $100 million Google agreed to pay in exchange for an exemption to the Online News Act, basically bribery. And this amounts to, this is crazy, the collective previously told eligible publishers they will likely receive $13,798 per full-time equivalent journalist employed based on a 2,000-hour work year. But it actually looks like it's about $18,000 to $20,000 per journalist. Out of this $100 million, this is in addition to the government funding that is directly subsidizing news media. Do you think maybe with all this money on the table, they only report what the government sees fit to print? That is Canada now, and that is the Canada you have a choice to vote against in this election. Polyev has promised to end this madness. We need a private media that stands on its own two feet in this country. and we should be looking to create it. And with that being said, I am trying to be part of that. If you like the work that I do, please consider supporting it via the website, and I will see you in the next one. Did you know that I have a website? FrankVaughn.ca, the ultimate repository for all of my work, and a backup location just in case the censors come for me again. And if you like the content, please consider using the donate link in one of the options available. There are no paywalls, there is no advertising, and there is no Patreon, and I intend to keep it that way. Thank you for your time and your consideration.